I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. For over four decades now, Bob MacDonald has devoted his working life to reporting on science, and in his inimitable way, he's brought the study of the world and the world around us closer to audiences on television through his writing and, of course, over 30 years on CBC Radio's Quirks and Quarks. In his new memoir, Just Say Yes, he tells the story of not just how he ended up one of the preeminent science correspondents in the country, but his beginnings in Orillia, Ontario. It was a blue-collar experience for Bob and his family. He writes of the challenges of living in a small town and the childhood abuse he suffered. He writes about all of his life candidly and captivatingly. It's, as I tell him in our interview we taped about 10 days ago, as though we can hear his voice as we read. Bob MacDonald has hosted Quirks and Quarks since 1992. He is a regular science commentator on CBC News Network and science correspondent for CBC's The National. Before that, he was the host and one of the producers of the television program Wonderstruck. He has received the 2001 Michael Smith Award for Science Promotion from the Natural Sciences and Engineering Council, as well as a 2002 Sanford Fleming Medal from the Royal Canadian Institute for Science. He also received the 2005 McNeil Medal from the Royal Society of Canada. He is an officer of the Order of Canada and the recipient of 13 honorary doctorates. In 2014, asteroid 332324 was officially named Bob MacDonald. This new book is published by Douglas and McIntyre. He joined me from his home in Victoria, B.C. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Bob MacDonald. Mr. MacDonald, good morning.
Good morning, Joe. Thanks for having me back.
Thanks for joining us. As I was telling you just before we started, how much I enjoyed the book. And the thing is, I was reading the book, and I reread parts of it the other night, and I'm sure you hear this from a lot of people. It's as though we hear you as we're reading.
Well, it's the story of my life, and it's a different kind of book that I've ever written before. I've always written about science. I usually include a little bit of myself in there, but I did this because people are always asking me, what's your background? Where did you get your PhD or things like that? And when I say, well, actually, I'm a university dropout and was a construction worker, they go, what? So how did you get the quirk? So I finally thought, okay, I guess I'll write it down and tell the story right from the beginning.
And that you do throughout the book. We read about your upbringing and the sort. This gift of storytelling, though, where does that come from? And you know, you talk about, by the way, you talk about your smile in the book. I can't help, when I listen to you on Saturdays at noon, I can't help but hear you smile through the radio.
Well, I am smiling because I find the stories that I'm hearing from these scientists all over the world fascinating. It's all new stuff. And, you know, life's too short to be grumpy. Laughing is great medicine. Yeah. So, you know, I've always had a good attitude towards life. And as far as the storytelling, I don't know. I guess I just have a gift of the gab. I like talking. I've had the experience at the Ontario Science Centre in Toronto of having to stand in front of audiences and school kids doing programs. And we had to do those out of our heads. There was no script. And so I got used to performing just using my mind instead of writing things down. And I still do that. Yeah. And so when it comes to the book, I like you said, I just write like I talk. It seems to work. People seem to like it, and I just let it flow out.
Yeah, that's what makes the book so engaging. In your family growing up, you mentioned construction work, but even as a kid, you were always interested in science. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely, because the whole space program happened in my lifetime. As a kid, I remember a headline on our local newspaper. I was in Ontario, Orillia, Ontario, and there was an illustration of the Earth with a circle around it and a little ball with antennas sticking out of it, and the headline was something like, Russians put up first artificial moon, and it was Sputnik, the first satellite. And I was totally captivated by that. Space, wow, there's stuff in space. And I just stayed with it, and I followed all the early, you know, the Mercury 7 astronauts, I knew all their names. And then when we started going to the moon, I stayed with it. I watched all of the moon landings, not just the first one, and just stayed, you know, interested in space and what we were finding, and then robots going out to the planets. And later, when I became a journalist, it was a supreme pleasure to actually continue that and meet people who've been to the moon and follow the robots on every planet right up to Pluto. So science to me as a kid was magical. We were leaving the planet, and we got to the moon so fast. I figured that by the time the year 2024, I couldn't even imagine the year 2024 back then. But we'd be all over the solar system. You know, I'd be taking holidays on Mars by now.
So, like the Jetsons, right?
Yeah, that's right. And the Jetsons were on. I mean, we've got flying cars. And, you know, although we do have talking television now, that's kind of neat. But it was just a magical time. And so it always captivated me. I just wasn't good at doing it. I was never a good student. I'm terrible at math and chemical formulas and all that. So I wasn't a good student. But I still liked what science did, what science saw, what science was exploring or revealing or giving us exciting new products. So my interest was high, but I just wasn't good at doing it.
Yeah. Were you encouraged by your parents to I mean, there is a story in the book about how your mother brings home this book that, you know, and you still have it, right?
Yes, I do. It was called The Planets. It was one of the very few books that she brought home. It's a Golden Library of Knowledge, which were these books for kids. It's thin, it's a hardcover, but it had illustrations in it. And they were trying to be like mini encyclopedias for kids. So this one's called The Planets, and it had illustrations of all the planets, both from what they look like in telescopes, but what they might look like from the surface, because this was before the space program. And there was one image in particular that really captured me, and it's an image of Jupiter as taken from one of its moons, its closest moon. And it said, from this moon, it showed a landscape and then Jupiter on the horizon. It said, from this moon, Jupiter would fill one-fourth of your sky. And I thought about that. I was old enough to know fractions. That's a lot. And I actually did a little experiment. I went out and I looked at our moon next time I saw it, and I measured it. If you just hold your arm straight out and measure the moon, you know how big it is? It's the size of an aspirin.
Wow.
It's the size of an aspirin with your hand straight out. Try it next time you see it. So I thought, wow, if Jupiter would fill a quarter, that must be amazing. This is a real place that I might visit someday. And so it just captured my imagination. So as a kid, I knew about all the planets. And then to actually be there at Mission Control in the 70s, 80s, and 90s when we went to the planets with robots, it was just a complete fulfillment.
Yeah, it's remarkable to think about, you know, you as a kid and imagining what the world around us is like. And then seeing where we are in 2024 with our phones and just that technology we have on Earth and what we can see beyond. It's a remarkable journey.
And it didn't turn out like the Jetsons.
Our
cars still run on the roads, but they're different. They're more efficient. Now some of them are electric. And, you know, the Internet, we had no concept of that kind of thing. Or cell phones that you carry around in your pocket that can talk to space and tell you where you are and you're on the planet now. So some things are still the same, but a whole lot isn't.
Well, what does Aurelia mean to you today?
Well, it's funny because I was there just a few days ago talking about this book, and it was quite emotional for me, actually. I had an event, and about 150 people showed up. I walked around in my old neighborhood, and I noticed that, you know, the streets are smaller now. The hills aren't as high. And everything's cool. But it was quite nostalgic and cathartic. I mean, I go back there once in a while. I still have cousins that live there. And it was good to sort of walk around and marvel at the fact that I'm so far away from where I was then.
Yeah.
And imagine if I could travel back in time and talk to this kid that was in and out of the water. Aurelia is on a lake, and there's a big town park, and that's where I spent most of my time in the summertime. But if I could go back in time and say, you know, one day people are going to want your autograph. Yeah, sure. One day the governor general is going to hang a medal around your neck. I wouldn't have believed any of that.
And they have your photo up at City Hall there with Stephen Leacock and Gordon Lightfoot, right?
Yes, indeed. And that was a huge honor that Aurelia inducted me into their Hall of Fame. And one year they even had banners of famous Aurelians hanging on the main street, and I was one of them. And it's humbling, you know, to see that. And speaking of Gordon Lightfoot, my older sister dated him in high school.
Really?
Yeah.
As you write in the book, you did leave behind a lot there. And in a way, a lot of it does stay with you. The poverty, the being middle class, the abuse, the shame. How do you not let it defeat you wherever you end up, say, in life?
Well, yeah, we were a low income family, and I had an alcoholic father who was abusive. Yes, I was abused by my dad one night. I was abused by a teenager, older boy who was much bigger than me, a couple of years later in a park. And home was a violent place that I didn't like to go to. But there's a double-edged sword to that. Because I didn't like going home, I spent a lot of time outdoors, and a lot of that alone. And the world was not a scary place to me. In fact, it felt safer than home. And that's done me well. I took half a year in my late 20s and went all the way around the world just by myself just to see what it looks like. And I wasn't afraid, and nothing bad happened. People were really good. And it's given me a sense of adventure and travel, which I still have today. As far as the abuse goes, I had to lock that away. I had to just put it away because, of course, it was never talked about. And as a kid, you're totally helpless. Who are you going to talk to, especially when it's your father, the person who's supposed to protect you? So I just found a place deep in my memory, and I created a mental vault with a big door and a big lock. I locked those memories in there, and I hold the key, and I just didn't open it. It was 65 years ago this year that happened, and I've never talked about it in public. This is the first time. And it was hard for me to write about it and drum it up and even talk to you about it now. But I've been overwhelmed by the response I've gotten from people saying, thank you for speaking out about it. I've had similar problems, but I'm also trying to offer some hope. I'm trying to be a living example of someone who got over childhood abuse and got on with my life. I just didn't think, well, you can't, the memories never go away, but I just locked them away and I didn't let them cripple me. I didn't let them control my life. And you can do that because if you do let someone foolish in the past, someone selfish or somebody drunk take advantage of you, if that affects you all the way into your adult life, you're still giving them power. And they don't deserve that. They don't deserve that power over you. So you fight that by putting it away and just getting on with it and saying yes to opportunities that point in directions you want to go. And that's what I've done. This is the story of my life.
Yeah, it's a
you can do it.
Yeah, just like the title. It's a marvelous lesson. As we read, the pain is obviously there as we read the book, but there is that hope, and that hope has sustained you throughout your whole career, hasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we all have stories of the past. We have scars. You know, you scratch yourself up or you cut yourself, you get a scar on your arm, but you don't think about it for the rest of your life. So you got a scar. Big deal. You get on with it and keep moving ahead. And I've been fortunate that friends and coworkers and mentors have pointed me in directions and said, hey, so-and-so is looking for someone. You'd be good at that. Give it a shot. And they give me a little pat on the back. And I go, okay, try it. And it's just been remarkable how this has happened to me over and over again. And for some reason, I found the courage to say yes and jump in, even though I didn't have experience, not officially qualified to do it. But I've had the enthusiasm to do it.
Yeah.
And that counts.
And you do name names in the book in terms of the people over the years who encouraged you, who said, you know, phoned you up and said, you know, they're looking for somebody here, and calling them up. And as you mentioned earlier, you were a construction worker, and you, I guess, were you working outside the Ontario Science Centre and then you just walk in?
Almost. I was working, I worked with a crew, and we made billboards. Outdoor signs, the kind you see on top of buildings or in fields, the really big ones. And it was my my girlfriend at the time who was working at the Science Center as a student. And they hired them during the summer. And she tipped me off. She said, you know, when we go back to school, they're hiring full-time people to do the shows, do the demonstrations where you stand people's hair up with static electricity or freeze flowers in liquid nitrogen, that kind of thing. And she said, you'd be good at that because I had done some theater in school. In fact, that's how we met. We acted in a play together. So I like theater, I like science, and this brought the two of them together. So I took a little company time, and I drove the truck to the Science Center, and I met this guy who was hiring, and I just talked his ear off. I said, I'd love to work here. This combines my love of theater, my love of science. You're together. You're doing shows. It's really great, and I don't even know what I said. And I just talked his ear off, and he just stopped me at one point, and he said, you're the kind of person we'd like to hire? like to have here? And he hired me on the spot. My whole life changed. Yeah. Right there at that moment. And so I went from being a blue-collar worker with my name on my chest to wearing a white lab coat, standing up on a stage, wowing people with static electricity and all this stuff. And I had the fortune just last year to contact him again, John Powell. Mm-hmm. He's now in his 90s, but he's still around. And I found him, and I went and I visited him, and I told him about that day, and he says, "I remember saying that to you." I remember saying that to you. So it's really divine, and I have a number of people who've done that. Because a little pat on the back goes a long, long way, especially when you feel like you're not good enough, which I have all my life. You know, you come from low-income family. We couldn't do the things that other families did, so you feel like you're subpar. But when somebody pats you on the back and say, "Hey, you could do that," or when you do something and say, "That was really good, do it again," it's jet fuel for the emotions.
Yeah, you talk about imposter syndrome and contending with that over the years. The book opens as you receive one of your many honorary doctorates, and you realize that you'd never seen your name on a diploma before, on a university diploma, that is. Does that imposter syndrome, is that something that comes up at all even now? Did you still feel it, say?
Not so much now, because I've come out about the fact that I'm not educated. And people go, "Wow, that's really interesting that you managed to get an education, but in a different way, not through the formal system." But yeah, I mean, I get invited to speak at scientific conferences and give a keynote speech. So there I am, up on the stage behind a podium in a room full of PhDs, and I'm the least educated person in the room, and I'm the one giving the keynote speech. And I would think, "My God, what am I doing up here? I shouldn't be talking to them." But I realized early on that what I can provide is a perspective as a journalist. I'm not going to tell them about their science, but I can tell them about how I see things because I talk to so many different scientists that it gives me an overview effect. And I had one invitation that was that really struck me. It was a supreme compliment. But I was invited to speak to a group of astronomers having a conference here in Victoria. They asked me to give a keynote talk. And I said, "What can I tell you about astronomy that you don't already know?" And they said, "Nothing. But it's not what you tell us. It's how you tell us. It's you're a communicator. And that's what we want to learn. We want to see how you communicate because we're not good at it." And I realized, yeah, that's what I do. I seem to have a gift to be able to talk and keep people's interest and make it funny and get information across. So you find out what your role is. And so in that regard, I'm not an imposter, but people think I'm an expert in science and stuff. I know a little bit about a lot of things, but I'm not a PhD.
How often is it, Bob, when you're talking to people for Quirks and Quirks, that you're talking to very learned scientific people, that it's unlistenable or that they just don't come across as well as they should to an audience? Are there times where you have to say stop the tape and redo things with them?
Oh, yes. We pre-record all of our interviews on Quirks and Quarks, and that has happened where I'll say, can we take another try at that? Or my other tool is that if they do get into their jargon or say something that's really complicated, I've been at it long enough that I understand the scientific language pretty well. So what I'll try to do is spin it back to them in plain English and sometimes with an analogy. And I'll say, "Okay, well, let me see if I got this right. Anytime you hear me say that, let me see if I got this right." That's me thinking on the spot and trying to spin it. So I'll spin it back in one sentence and say something like, is it shaped something like a donut? And they'll say, "Well, yeah, but it doesn't have a hole in the middle," or something like that. I don't know. I'll think of it. And then we get on with the conversation. And that's me trying to keep the story clear, because it's all about storytelling. And I see myself as a translator between the science and you, the public. Yeah. And the more I thought about it, the fact that I don't have a formal education actually keeps me closer to you so that I can understand what they're saying and translate it over. But I did have a scientist one time at one of our universities. He came up to me. He'd been on the show a couple of times. And he said, "You know, in our lab, when we're on your show, we try to get through an interview without you saying, let me see if I got this right. He said, because if you do that, we failed. And so that's my job. I'm an interpreter of science.
And I can't tell you how many Saturday nights I go to dinner with people, how much smarter I sound because of something that I'll deploy from something I heard on the show that, you know, at noon, you know.
Yeah.
This fascination with space, that's throughout the book. You even talk about that in terms of, say, riding your motorcycle as you do, or even sailing. Is motorcycling, if that's the right term for riding a bike, because I know you've ridden a zero-G airplane, is that the closest one could feel to like being in space?
Sometimes it's the closest thing to flying that you can get without leaving the ground.
I see.
And I've always had a motorcycle, and I still ride today. And I do long-distance riding, like cross-continent stuff, 10, 15,000-kilometer trips at a time. And it's a way of exploring the planet. It's like taking a giant walk across the country because you're always outside.
Yeah.
So you feel the cool going over the mountain peaks. You feel the heat in the prairies. I was in California this summer down south of San Francisco, and it was 46 degrees down there. Mm. I was just dying in the heat. That's all part of it. And it's a way of exploring planet Earth. And I use, when I travel, I mean, I'm always interested in going places I haven't been before and seeing not only interesting geography like the Grand Canyon or the Rocky Mountains or whatever, but meeting the people in different parts of the world. But I also have scientific eyes when I'm traveling around. So I'll see things like, the Rocky Mountains, you know, they're all in lines. And I see that as the crumpled fender of North America as it runs into the floor of the Pacific Ocean. Because plate tectonics is pushing North America towards the west at about the speed your fingernails grow, which isn't very fast, but it's irresistible. And the mountains got pushed up by that force. So I see this, you know, the lifting forces, again, and how strong that force is to push those mountains up like that. Or if you stand in the foothills of the Rockies and turn the other way, look out over the prairies,
yeah.
You see the pan. You're looking at an ancient seabed. Because it was an ocean that went all the way from the Gulf of Mexico to the Arctic. And so you're standing on an ancient shoreline when you're in the foothills, which is why all the dinosaur bones are there. That's where they lived, is along the shore. So I see things in that context because I've got a little education in geology or paleontology or whatever. And it's great. Same thing with the weather. You know, you look at on a motorcycle, you're always looking at the weather because you're trying to avoid storms.
Sure.
But you can see them coming, and you see the formations of the clouds and whatnot. So it's very entertaining. It enriches the travel experience for me.
Yeah, I'll bet, yeah. You know, the sailing chapter is just riveting. I mean, there are episodes in there that are just exciting to read. But I particularly enjoyed how you narrate New York City as you're sailing through the water there. I mean, it's cinematic the way you wrote that.
It was remarkable. That was my first long-distance trip. In 1992, it was the 500th anniversary of Columbus's voyage. Mm. So New York City had a tall ship parade. So all these tall sailing ships from around the world gathered, and there was a giant parade that went on all day long up the Hudson River. And I wanted to be there for that. And I was living in Toronto, and I had a sailboat. And there's a way you can go from Toronto to the Hudson River through a canal. It's called the Erie Barge Canal. You have to motor through it. And then you come down the Hudson, and then there's New York. The New York skyline shows up. And it's, you know, the Washington Bridge, the Statue of Liberty, the Brooklyn Bridge, and all the skyline. At that time, the World Trade Center was standing, the Empire State Building, all this stuff. It's New York. And I'm on my own boat sailing down the harbor, down the river. And that day that they had the parade, they designated anchorages along both sides of the river to keep the private boats away from the sailing ones, from the parade ships.
Yeah.
And one of the designated spots was the Statue of Liberty. And there's a shallow spot there beside it. So that's where I anchored. I anchored my boat and sat there sitting on my deck watching this parade of tall ships going by. And then that night they had a fireworks display where the whole Manhattan skyline lit up. They had fireworks coming off the roofs of the tall buildings and the bridges and all. It was the most spectacular thing I've ever seen. And sailing has become I still sail now. I have a boat here in Victoria.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful way to travel.
Yeah.
I've been all over the Great Lakes, the East Coast, Bahamas, Florida, and here out west. I've completely circumnavigated Vancouver Island. And it's just a great way to travel. I really like it.
And as much as you've traveled on the water, space is something you'd still like to do, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I have a secret dream, actually. it's not so secret anymore, but I would like to get into space. I thought for a while there I had a shot at it because NASA actually had a journalist in space program that they were developing in the early days when the shuttles were first flying. And they thought they would be going up every week and there'd be lots of empty seats and they could put journalists up. And I thought maybe I'd have a shot at that. I'd be pretty low down on the line as a Canadian, but you know, I might have a shot. Then the Challenger disaster happened, which carried the first civilian, Christy McAuliffe, on it. And all of a sudden that journalist program just went away. But there's still a possibility that, I don't know, if I can find the funds to go up on one of those private rockets that Richard Branson and Jeff Bezos are blowing people up into space for a few minutes on these tourist flights.
Yeah.
And it would be really neat if Chris Hadfield was at the controls.
Oh, man, one. Yeah.
That would be cool. That would be cool.
That would be, yeah. You know, Bob, we live in a world today where there's a lot of questioning of science. And, you know, I can't help but think that we need a show like Quirks and Quarks more than ever. How are you navigating the discourse? I mean, you're on the radio an hour a week, but when you're out in the public and you hear what people are saying online as well about, doubting science and questioning it and the sort, you've done this your whole career as a journalist to explain science to people. I mean, what do you make of where we're headed and where we are, say?
I'm very disturbed about that, Joe, because it's confusing the public and it's confusing politicians and it's slowing down progress that we need right now. When I started out, as I said, scientists were like magicians and everybody was wowed by them and they were giving us wonder products and it was terrific. But now anyone with a video camera or a cell phone and a YouTube channel can put out whatever they want. And a lot of these people, conspiracy theorists, flat earthers, all those, they're very good at it. And if you don't know the science, you can start believing that they didn't land on the moon or something like that.
Yeah.
And there are also those who have an agenda. They don't want to hear what science has to say, like the climate is changing because of greenhouse gas emissions. Well, if they're in a business that puts out greenhouse gas, they don't want to hear that. So there are campaigns, and we know that now, that have been funded by industry to say climate change is wrong, science is wrong, the science is uncertain, don't believe it. And this is to try to keep business as usual. And I really worry about that. So it's incumbent upon teachers and parents of young people, because they are the future decision makers, to teach them how to tell the difference between the real science and the pseudoscience. And the main way you do that is look at who's talking. Mm. Who is this person?
Yeah.
Is it a scientist from an institution like UBC, University of Toronto, McGill, or something like that? Or is it someone who has an opinion? Is it someone who created an institute and made themselves the head of it and called themselves an expert? Are they really an expert? Or are they just saying things out of the top of their head? That's not how science works. Science works on evidence and fact and building on itself. And it's a well-established organization. But if you don't know the difference and how they work, it can be confusing. So, yeah, I get annoyed sometimes, although I try to be patient and explain things, but there's an effect. It's like a club effect. Once you join the club, then you don't want to hear any other evidence, so you stay with it.
Yeah.
And, we're living in this post-fact society now, which I found astounding. I don't understand that. Because the truth never lies.
Mm.
And that's the thing about science. That's its goal, is to find the truth about how the universe works. So we got to keep it. And Quirks and Quarks, by the way, next year is its 50th anniversary on the air.
Wow.
And I've only been doing it for 30 of those years. But the show itself, the ratings have never gone down over 50 years. And it's amazing how all all we do is present the science. Here's what happened this week. That's all we do. We just present the science. We don't do opinions and commentaries. Yeah. It's very seldom. And that's, people are interested in that. People want to know. So the science is a powerful tool that can not only point out problems like climate change, but it can also point to solutions. And those solutions are there. My last book was called The Future Is Now, Solving the Climate Crisis with Today's Technologies. And I make the point there that all the technology we need to produce energy without carbon emissions already exists. We don't have to invent anything new. We can do it now, but we need to proceed, and we need to have a scientifically literate society to make those intelligent decisions. So that's why I'll do my best to try to keep promoting science as long as I can.
Yeah, long may it continue. So, you know, the talk of science at its heart is the study for human survival. As you think about all of this stuff regularly because of your line of work, how optimistic are you about our future as humans?
I kind of go up and down about that. When I talk to scientists, and I get optimistic because they're pointing to sensible ways to survive in the future, yeah, on how we can produce energy or food or water or whatever. When I see some of the crazy stuff that's out there and the way we behave and not wanting to change, I get discouraged. You know, people say, oh, we have to save the planet. We don't have to save the planet. The Earth has been through change before. It's the dominant species that we need to worry about, and we are that. So it's in our best interest to do it. And I just hope that common sense will prevail, that common sense will prevail. And now that climate change is in our face, BC is just burning up now with the forest fires and the heat waves, mm-hmm, and down south and drought conditions down there. So we're seeing it now. We're seeing storms are stronger. All of the predictions that they were making back in the 70s are coming true. And I think we're reaching a turning point where people are realizing, yeah, you know, the way we're doing this stuff is not good. We have to transition away from that, and I believe the transition is happening. So I try to keep optimistic about it. We got to the moon, for God's sakes. We did that.
Indeed.
We did it in 8 years, and it was all new technology. But the people who got us to the moon were all young. All those white shirts that were in mission control there and the astronauts were all under 30. That's amazing. It was young people that got us to the moon. So that's why I focus a lot of my work to young people, because they're the ones who are going to be the future politicians, business people, scientists, whoever, who make decisions about how we're going to proceed. So we got to get them.
Yeah. And your message is resonating with young people. I mean, you make presentations all the time to schools, school-age children, mm-hmm, I should say.
Yes.
They are getting it, aren't they? And well, what is it like, though, Bob, when someone says, I grew up watching you, say, you know, on TV, on Wonderstruck or something like that? Is that fun, or is that unnerving at times?
I now have scientists that I'm interviewing on Quirks and Quarks who said I used to watch it as a kid. It makes me feel old, and I am old, but it's also heartwarming. It's just heartwarming for me because we throw these programs out to the air and we have no idea who's listening or what effect it's having. And when someone does that to me, either in the street, hey, I watched you as a kid, you got me into science, now I'm a doctor, or now I'm an engineer, or whatever, my heart just swells. And I'm so grateful when that happens. And to know that I've made a difference in someone's life is very heartwarming. So I'll keep trying to inspire as long as I can.
Absolutely. You know, if people didn't love and admire you for your work, I can't see how they'll read this book and not admire you a hell of a lot more. Bob, it's a beautiful book. Congratulations and continued good luck with it. I so appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much, Joe. It was really fun talking to you.
The book is called Just Say Yes. It's published by Douglas and McIntyre. It's author Bob McDonald. Join me on the line from Victoria in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.